host, Dmitry Filipovich.
Welcome to the Hockeypedia Cast. My name is Dmitry Filipovich. We are back here for part two of our round one preview extravaganza, joined by both Jack Hahn and Jack Fraser as we're breaking all the series down. We did a bunch of West series in part one, so go and listen to that if for some reason you're starting off listening to us here. We'll jump to the East now, and we're going to talk about the Battle of Florida, which I think is incredibly fascinating and has a ton of storylines. Hahn, where are you at with this series between the Panthers and the Lightning in terms of how they shake out on paper and sort of how this series could look like and whatever interesting strengths or weaknesses you think they respectively have that the other team can capitalize on?
So first of all, I don't know which series is going to be more toxic, especially after the whistle. Is it going to be this one or Toronto-Boston? But I digress. Certainly, I think you guys both tweeted about this, and it's how dominant the Barkov and Forsling duo have been in terms of tilting the play, but also outscoring opponents at 5-on-5. And then on the other side, obviously, we have Kucherov, who's having a season for the ages and who's MVP of the league, you know, for me, just because if it weren't for him, I don't even think Tampa would be in the playoffs right now. So I think that's the main matchup I'm looking for there.
I'm obviously looking forward to that one as well. I think Florida's aggression, Fraser, is so fascinating to me because they are, you know, Hahn mentioned there off the top about with toxic. I think this one clearly, just because Florida is chaos personified in the NHL. They're first in the league in penalties drawn. They're second in the league in penalties taken. There's no real off switch for them, right? Like, the reason why they're so successful and so exhausting to play against is because they just challenge every single puck. Sometimes they go over the line. They certainly initiate a scrum after every single whistle purposefully to try to get you off your game, and it winds up working for them. And I think there's a kind of an unquantifiable cumulative effect of it over a 7-game series. We certainly saw last year, and I'll be fascinated to see, like, Kucherov, even though he's a veteran and he's sort of been exposed to it all, we've seen him in the past lose his cool and recklessly act out in retaliation, and Florida's certainly going to try to get that out of him. But what I'm looking for in this series from Florida's aggression is they played the fewest amount of 5-on-5 minutes on average in the league this season. It was about 46 minutes only per game out of the 60. And they have strong special teams, certainly. They're top 10 in both penalty kill and power play rate. But the issue is Florida's better at, or Tampa Bay is better at both, essentially. And Florida's one real strength in this series for me is that 5-on-5 play. Like, Tampa Bay got outscored by 19 goals at 5-on-5 this year. They were 24th in 5-on-5 goal differential. And that's a decisive advantage for Florida, where they've been one of the best 5-on-5 teams in the league, and particularly controlling the play. And so you can't necessarily change the way you play, because I just said this is why they're so successful. But theoretically, I imagine they would prefer to keep this game played at even strength as often as possible against the Tampa Bay team.
Yeah, 100%. Like, you know, I see that as being potentially the thing that makes this series unravel quickly for the Panthers. And I am a firm Panthers believer. Like, I think that they're a great team. You know, that was the foreshadowing when I said earlier on that I'm looking at all these teams and I'm thinking, why are they all trying to look like the Carolina Hurricanes? I mean, you look at the Panthers, you know, similarly, like, so much quantity chances, attempts, shots off the same possessions, low to high passes, point shots, dump-ins, you know, retrievals, like all of that. Like, it's so similar. And I mean, similarly incredible defensively as the Carolina Hurricanes. But they really kind of take it that one extra step. And, you know, the Hurricanes take plenty of penalties, but I feel like the Panthers have just upped the level of just pure aggression. And, you know, we know based on, you know, numbers that have consistently been the case in the past that penalties, you know, especially minor penalties, do go up, you know, not only in the first round of the playoffs, but in the first couple games of the first round. Like, you almost always see kind of a march to the penalty box early on in first round series. You know, we know the refs like to put the whistles away later in series and then as the playoffs go along. But, you know, the number of penalties called, you know, in games 1, 2, 3, 4 is a lot higher than it is in the regular season on average. And that's an area where I could see a situation where, you know, the Panthers really want to set the tone early on. They get in a lot of penalty trouble, and then suddenly they're matched up against, you know, this overpowered Tampa Bay cheat code of a power play that has just been tearing teams apart all season, because, you know, that puck goes to the right side of the ice and anything can happen after that. So, you know, on paper, the Florida Panthers really should be able to control the pace of the series. They should be able to, you know, certainly suppress, you know, anything that the bottom part of that Tampa Bay lineup has to offer, and maybe even contain and frustrate the top of it, you know, especially considering how strong their forecheck is and how depleted the Tampa Bay Lightning's defense is in terms of guys who can actually move the puck properly. But, you know, game one, game two, game three, maybe they step over the line, march to the penalty box, and suddenly we're talking about Tampa stealing a game at home and then stealing two games at home, and suddenly things could spiral.
It certainly could, huh? And I'm so fascinated by this because actually, ironically, last year's round one series, the three of us previewed the Panthers Bruins, and we talked a lot. I think we were one of the few people who kind of gave the Panthers a real chance in that series because of their chaos and their willingness to embrace it versus Boston's sort of like very controlled science of a game and how they made them play that way and made them uncomfortable. And then they wound up winning that series. In this case, you have this Tampa team that's first in the league on the power play. They're generating about 11 goals per hour this season. And I think in just thinking about it as well, like you watch some of these games between them, and I think Kucherov's like puppeteering and playing style in terms of generating off the wall the way he does works as on the power play against every penalty kill. But this Panthers team is so aggressive in their approach, and that extends their PK as well. And so they're all of a sudden like chasing pucks. They're kind of moving out of position. They're following players, trying to create turnovers and rush the other way. And then all of a sudden that plays right into Kucherov's hands, where he's sort of uniquely equipped to pass under extreme pressure, still get the puck right on the money to an open target. And it's either on points tape of his stick in the slot, or a stamp goes for that one timer at the other circle. And so that's a very dangerous game for them to be playing. And I think this Tampa team in general kind of embraces that chaos as well. Like they sometimes thrive on these broken plays where they've got guys like Hagel and Nick Paul, and obviously Kucherov, Point, and Stamkos. They can immediately make you pay if things kind of escalate too quickly that way. So how do you sort of balance that from Florida's perspective? Because you can't change the way you're playing. Like that's what makes you so good. But you also got to be careful about stepping into doing exactly what Tampa Bay wants you to do.
Well, I think the actual approach will be very similar to last year's Boston series, in the sense that internally, Florida is going to say that we're the underdogs and we're going up against Tampa, who's got all these, you know, great players, and they're scoring a ton of goals, and you know they've beaten us in the playoffs and they get all the respect. We don't get any respect. Like, so I think in terms of the attitude and the mental approach, the Panthers are very much looking to replicate kind of that internal narrative that they had last year. And I think it is going to work well for them. It's going to get them motivated and ready to play. And, you know, Kucherov on the power play, it's very much like McDavid or McKinnon. Like, you can only hope to contain them, and, you know, you're never really going to neutralize them completely. But, you know, Florida's got a really good power play too. Like, they got some really sneaky plays, especially from Reinhardt, like whether it's off the entry or end zone. So, you know, like, Kucherov will get his points. The Tampa power play will get their goals, but I think there's a lot there for Florida at 5-on-5 and also on their power play.
Yeah, I will say Florida's power play certainly has been good, especially since they put Carter Verhaeghe in the shooter spot and went 4 forwards, 1D. Now, the issue is that Tampa Bay's penalty kill with guys like Hagel and Cirelli has been really good, particularly of late. And so maybe the answer is because of how Florida creates in the power play, it's a lot of like down low triangle working it through Tkachuk. And so in that way, you're essentially isolating Tampa Bay's defenders and you're not worrying about those stud forward penalty killers. And so maybe it'll work anyways. But Fraser, what I'm so fascinated by in this is you mentioned kind of Florida's volume approach, and then Tampa Bay certainly got the efficiency. The last two games these two teams played, Florida just blew them out of the water. One of them, it was a 9-2 blowout. The other one, Tampa Bay won 5-3, and it kind of illustrated that, where I believe shots were 50-16 for the Panthers in it, but Tampa Bay, through their efficiency at both ends of the ice, wound up stealing that game. We could see a lot of that here. I know this kind of runs counter to what I said off the top, but Florida's offense has quietly struggled at 5-on-5 this season, particularly in terms of efficiency. They're 22nd in 5-on-5 goal scoring this season, which is actually behind the Rangers, a team that gets derided for their 5-on-5 offense and scoring. And Tampa Bay's defense is quietly as well improved as the year went along. All of their underlying metrics on Sportlogic have improved into top 10 status essentially this season. So I'm curious to see how Florida is going to be able to create there, because they're going to certainly get their looks. Like, I think a lot of these shot, like there's going to be a lot of screen grabs that I'm going to be doing of the shots being like 40 to 17, 45 to 21 for Florida. But how they meaningfully create offense, because actually at 515, they've become this team that's so good defensively, and that's why they win. But offense has been actually a bit of a struggle sometimes at even strength.
Yeah, I think that there are ways that they kind of work around a little bit. I mean, you know, obviously, you know, I mean, 24th in 5-on-5 goals this year, like you said. I think that their process is good, and it's maybe not necessarily, we're not necessarily looking at a Carolina situation where it's all just spamming shots and all that. I mean, they have a lot of great playmakers on the team. You know, the Carolina Hurricanes in the past have not had a passer of the caliber of Matthew Tkachuk. And, you know, you look at the other guys on the roster, they have a lot of passing skill as well. I think that there's more creativity going on with the Panthers, and we should give them a little bit of credit for that, even if kind of the locus of everything is those kind of low high passes. I mean, so much going on from behind the net, especially like they work it down low and then they get it high for a point shot or for the defenseman to skate in, but also a lot of passes from behind the net into the slot as well, which is not necessarily a hallmark of those kind of quantity teams that are less skilled. So I, you know, the finishing not so good this year. It was strong last season, you know, at 5-on-5. I wouldn't be too concerned. And actually, I think that might be an area where we could see some positive regression, you know, where we could see the Panthers actually potentially take a next step. The question obviously being, is Vasilevskiy going to give them the opportunity to do that? But, you know, I think another factor for me with that Panthers offense is that, you know, one thing that we really haven't seen from them in their past couple seasons, you know, in this kind of Barkov window that they've had of contention, is I don't think we've seen that kind of next level offensive playoffs from Barkov himself. You know, he was fine last season. He produced at an okay rate, but certainly a step down from the regular season. He wasn't one of their top scoring chance creators, you know, and last season, especially, you know, I was looking at the numbers in terms of scoring chances created last in that finals run. And Sam Reinhart was really far down the list. Like, he really struggled to kind of generate offense. And a part of that came from them being played in more of a matchup role. But I would like to see them, you know, maybe not rely quite so heavily on Matthew Tkachuk and Carter Verhaeghe, and see if we can kind of get that true elite, you know, two-way postseason from guys like Barkov and Reinhart, because I think they do offer that level of creativity that can surpass maybe the quantity-based or lesser, you know, skill-based offense that we might ascribe to them.
That's true. I think in this series, we're going to see a lot of them on Kucherov, and maybe the answer is that, like, they just create more offensively and make Kucherov defend, and that's part of it. But I just can't wait to see that sort of strength on strength there in terms of their attention to detail and discipline, and the fact that, as we mentioned, Barkov and Forsling in particular didn't give up anything on the ice when they were together, and now they're going against this absolute offensive genius. Han, let's end on this with this series. I want to talk about Florida's forecheck against this Lightning defense, because I think we've seen they've become very willing to essentially, like, they puck hunt all over the ice, right? So they're willing to flip the puck out of the zone and sort of engage in these 50-50 battles. We've seen Tampa Bay's defensemen, I know there's some different names involved there now, but in the past two postseasons kind of struggle with some of those plays where Toronto's forwards would flip the puck up into their feet, chase after it, and they would struggle to make plays in tight, and that was a way to sort of punish them. Obviously, Florida's forecheck is incredibly aggressive here. They're going to send everyone into the zone and try to seal off the walls, force the puck into the middle. Tampa's a bit uniquely suited to potentially break through sometimes and create some odd man rushes off of it, because if Kucherov's willing to make his plays deeper in the defensive zone, no one's better at getting the puck off of those sort of rims and getting into the middle and breaking through that type of press. So I'm curious to see about that. But how does Tampa Bay sort of combat that and make life easier for their defensemen against this very aggressive Panthers forecheck, so that they avoid just essentially being stuck in their own zone and turning the puck over and over again?
Well, the one play that we've seen Tampa use increasingly over the years is the weak side rim. So the D would just take the puck and just rim it to, whether it's to their partner or whether it's to the weak side winger. And what that does, it's basically quote unquote a safe way to move the puck out of pressure. If you do it early, it can be very effective. It can even create a 3-on-2 or 2-on-1 on the other side of the ice. The problem is, if you're just a little bit late, all of a sudden you're trying to jam this puck into a pinching Panthers defenseman, or maybe their weak side winger gets there first. And then all of a sudden you're in a bad gap because you're under the goal line rimming pucks. And then you got to step out, you know, into the shot lane. And you know, that's major trouble. So, you know, like for better or for worse, I think Tampa's pretty much that kind of a breakout team now. They don't really use the middle as much as they did, let's say, a decade ago, or even 5 or 6 years ago. So if Florida is able to get on the forecheck early and cut off that weak side rim, then Tampa's in trouble. Whereas if Florida's just a little bit late, or you know, it hops over their stick or something, then it's a way for Tampa to get some quick offense. So very much sort of like a luck or bounce based play, but we'll see what happens there.
Well, I can't wait to watch it. It's going to be a really fun one. All right, let's move on to Islanders, Hurricanes. Fraser, I'm going to do the mean thing here and make you talk a little bit about Jake Ensel, because I think that we've seen 17 games of it now. They've clearly changed as a team the way they're playing, at least compared to the past. And I think we've seen some fundamental changes there in terms of their offensive approach. But I think for me, like, I've seen enough now to feel much more confident that whatever previous limitations they had every postseason, they've done at least enough to address it for now and hopefully avoid another reoccurrence of it. And so this line with Gensel, Jarvis, and Aho has just been so good at creating offensively for them so far. And I really believe, like, sometimes it is as simple as that it alleviates a lot of whatever concerns I had previously. And then they obviously have the defensive system and everything else that made them special in the first place.
Yeah. I mean, it's what Penguins fans have been saying about Gensel for years, which is that if you were just looking at him and looking at his number, his time on ice with Crosby, and assuming that he was just a product of Sid, then you weren't watching him carefully enough. You know, it's the level of hockey IQ that he has makes him and made him such a perfect fit for this Carolina Hurricanes team, where, you know, he's smart enough and reactive enough that, you know, Carolina obviously plays with a lot of pace and pressure, and you put him in that situation, he's going to thrive. He can make quick decisions. You know, he knows how to cut to the net on plays, but he's also, you know, you slow things down, the sustained offensive zone possessions. You know, if he has the puck on his stick, then he knows how to manipulate defenses and get the puck back to the dangerous areas. If he's playing off puck, you know, there's few players in the NHL who are better at manipulating opposing defenses and getting, you know, into that kind of back door or into the slot and being lost in coverage. And, you know, as hard as it is for me as a Penguins fan to watch him do it on the Hurricanes, I'm not surprised at all at how brilliant a fit that he's been, how well he's fit in, and how adaptable that has made this Hurricanes team. Because you looked at their numbers, the way that they create, it's kind of always been, you know, Aho and Svechnikov and maybe niches on an island in terms of how they're making offense happen. And then everybody else is just doing the same dump and chase, dump and chase, dump and chase, point and shot, rebound, et cetera. You know, even just adding kind of one player of that, you know, extremely strong skill set as Gensel, I think opens a lot of things up. It allows them to play in more various ways and not kind of be that one trick pony that we almost inevitably see, you know, teams matching up properly, or they get hit by a hot goalie, or, you know, in some cases they just run out of gas. You know, obviously recently they've been decent at getting out of the first round, even just playing the somewhat limited way that they have. And I am fairly confident that they're going to be able to do that in this case as well. But, you know, I think that this, you know, even if they do win this series handily, which obviously is not a guarantee in today's NHL, but even if they do win it handily, I think that this will be a pretty good testing ground for how the Carolina Hurricanes can actually take that next step and be a team that can get into the Cup Finals and maybe even contend. And it will be interesting to see.
Yeah, Han, I already did a detailed deep dive of this with Belfry recently, so I don't want to rehash it too much, but I think the point worth hammering here is pre-deadline, they averaged 5.6 rush chances per game as a team, which was 25th in the league. Post-deadline, when Gensel arrived, they're averaging 7.6 rush chances per game. Only the Avalanche averaged more than that this season. Their re-entry game and regroups in the neutral zone have been on point. They're clearly making a point of attacking off of entry and carrying the puck into the zone much more often rather than dumping it in the way they used to deliberately set up those point shots. And it seems like a fundamental shift and some sort of a concession by either Rod Brind'Amour or their front office that they needed to do this to make the next step. So I want to see that play out in the postseason to see if that continues. The more interesting thing, though, is the power play, where only Tampa Bay and Edmonton have been more efficient at creating on the power play in terms of goals this season. they put Jake Ensel in the middle of the ice. They have Jarvis around the net. Their puck movement is on point as well. And so that against this Islanders penalty kill, which it's kind of marginalized a little bit by the fact that they don't really take a high volume of penalties themselves, although maybe Carolina's puck possession will force them into more of those, but they've been league worst at giving up shorthanded goals against, and or I guess goals against when they're on the penalty kill. It hasn't really gotten better under Patrick Waugh. We're going to talk a lot about the defensive adjustments they've made under Waugh at 5-on-5 and how they've improved as a result. We haven't seen that carry over to when they're playing down a man. And against this Canes power play, which has been really good this year, that seems like a major red flag in this series for the Islanders.
Yeah, the Isles PK is not good. Okay. And not only are they not good, but I would say that they're actually actively taking their excellent goaltending off the table, because you know they give up one-timers through the seam, they give up shots from the middle of the slot, from the bumper position, they give up screen point shots, like they give up every which way kinds of shots. So the goalies, you know, there's something that's going to go through, because the goalies don't really get a good handle of what kind of things that they can expect to stop.
So they have made, I mentioned those changes that they've made under Patrick Waugh, though, at 5-on-5, and whether it's shots, high danger chances, expected goals, or goals, they've chopped off a pretty significant margin of what they were surrendering previously over these whatever 37 games or so under Patrick Waugh since the coaching change. And so that's really encouraging for this. Make a quick note kind of about what they've done there and how they've improved, because it's clearly been something that was a point of emphasis when he came over, and they immediately made those changes.
Yeah, well, I would say that the defensive improvements are the best out of any teams that's made a coaching change this season. For the past number of years, whether it's under Barry Trotz or Lane Lambert, the Isles were always about protecting the middle of the ice, absorbing, containing, blocking shots, and then, you know, sort of just protecting the house. Whereas under Waugh, he's gone to a much more aggressive game plan. Looks a lot like the way that Philly would defend the neutral zone, or you know, even Vancouver. They're way better at forcing turnovers, at denying entries, at the D's playing a tight gap, the D's taking away time and space inside the zone. I was really surprised to see this, because I didn't expect, with their personnel having, you know, played that passive way for so many years, that they were able to flip the switch, but they were able to do it. So I find that really impressive.
And so much has been made of their goal differential and how few regulation wins they have and how many overtime loser points they have. But it's worth noting they've actually spent quite a bit of time playing with the lead this season. I think that's what's made it even more frustrating or maddening, that a lot of these issues have been sort of coming from the fact that they've had leads and then they've been blowing games because they were so conservative and they were essentially just letting you to walk in their zone and just get quality shots against them. And so that's an interesting thing to note here. Fraser, I'm curious for your take on what the Islanders can do offensively against this Canes defense, because they're first again in expected goals against. They're first in fewest time allowed in the offensive zone. They give up the third fewest slot shots. Freddie Anderson, since he came back from his health scare on March 7th, 13 goals against in just 10 games, a .951 save percentage, which is preposterous. And so this Islanders team is going to be facing an uphill battle to create offense against them. They have some interesting pieces, certainly with the duo of Barzal and Horvat, and then also with Brock Nelson and Kyle Palmieri. But how do they kind of break through that and put together enough consistent offense to challenge Carolina in this series?
I mean, it's going to be super difficult. Like, you look at the series that this team has played against Carolina in recent memory, you know, Barzal has struggled to produce. He doesn't have a single, you know, assist in either of those series. You know, Bo Horvat struggled also last season against them. It's a real issue, because you look at the way that the guys on the Islanders who are actually capable of creating offense, and it's not necessarily that many guys, and they're kind of constrained to the top of the lineup. You know, in a lot of cases, the way that they do it is crashing the net and rebounds. You know, you think about Anders Lee in the slot and Kyle Palmieri, you know, even Bo Horvat, you know, kind of likes to get to that slot area. You know, we saw Matthew Barzal, I think, take that big next step in terms of his playmaking this season, you know, playing maybe less of a perimeter game, getting more pucks to the dangerous areas of the ice. But the question is just, are they going to get the opportunity to do that, or are they just going to be stuck counterattacking? And if they are stuck counterattacking, you know, can they just basically win an entire series on Brock Nelson goals? I wouldn't be necessarily so sure of that. But, like, you know, I'm just seeing a situation like what Jack alluded to. you know, with the more aggressive play that the Islanders are making defensively, you know, kind of challenging the man carrying the puck, whether in a lot of cases, you know, the Islanders are going to try to stand them up at the blue line, the Hurricanes are going to say, all right, fine, dump it in, force the Islanders defenseman to make a play. And one big weakness of this Islanders team is that a lot of them do struggle under pressure. You know, you look at the successful retrieval rates tracked by Corey Schneider, and you're looking at, you know, Noah Dobson struggling a lot, Romanov struggling a lot, you know, Mike Riley, that's been an area where he in the past has maybe struggled a bit against heavier forechecks. And there's not really, you know, except maybe Florida, a heavier forecheck than the Carolina Hurricanes. I can see a situation where the Islanders aren't even really getting very many opportunities to set up in the offensive zone at all. They just end up hemmed in, creating counterattacks. And it's one thing when it's Brock Nelson, but when it's, you know, Casey Cizikas or Cal Clutterbuck, you know, you're maybe not going to be able to rely on so many goals that way.
Yeah, the Isles are interesting offensively because, like, they don't spend a bunch of time in the zone. And so that's going to probably recur in this series. They aren't necessarily a volume team, but they've actually been very efficient at getting the puck into the middle of the ice there this season and getting it to those shooters. And they have shooting talent atop the lineup. So I'll be curious to see if they're able to kind of break through that defensive shell and get there. I think Dobson's health is going to be huge here. He missed the final four games. We'll see if he's able to come back and what he looks like, because I think at the very least his passing in zone and the ability to take the puck from the outer edges of the zone and get it into the middle of the ice facilitate a lot of that. And so if he's sort of weakened or hurt or even not playing, that's obviously going to be a big blow to that. And it's going to be a lot of Mike Riley, who I love and is certainly is the most irrational confidence defender in the league, I think, this side of Sean Durzi. But I think they're going to be hoping that, you know, Dobson's going to be able to come back and shoulder the heavy workload he did all season for them. Do you have any, Han, do you have any other notes on the Islanders, or do you think that's enough for this series?
Well, look, the Canes are favored. They're going to spend a ton of time in the Isle zone. They're going to get their share of shot attempts. Can the Isles get great goaltending and maybe turn a few of these block shots or, you know, high turnovers into something and give the Canes a scare? Possibly. Like, that's kind of the path for them.
Okay. Let's take our break here. And then when we come back, we'll finish up with the remaining series. You're listening to the Hockey PDOcast streaming on the Sportsnet Radio Network. All right. We're back here on the Hockey PDOcast. We're closing down the round one series. We're going to do Leafs Bruins here. Han, I'll give you the floor. What's the most interesting matchup for this series that's highly anticipated? We've seen it a bunch of times. Obviously, a lot of the names have changed since the last time we saw it, and the teams are certainly different. But what are you watching for in the series between the Leafs and the Bruins?
So recently I read a piece by your colleague Justin Bourne that he did with my former colleague Andrew Brewer, who was the Leafs video coach when I was a Marlies video coach, and they talked a lot about, you know, zone versus man-on-man defense in the playoffs. And, you know, I think Andrew's a big proponent of a zone defense, just because when you play man-on-man, you're, you know, one breakdown creates a cascade of other breakdowns that eventually lead you to possibly give up a goal or at least a high danger scoring chance. And what I would sort of counter to that is that when you look at how Toronto has done against Boston this year, obviously, Boston swept the season series, and the Bruins did a lot of their damage off of high cycles and extended ozone possessions against the Leafs. And where the Leafs got in trouble was they became a little bit too passive in their zone coverage. You know, the Leafs, they try to play a hybrid, sort of a man-on-man up high and then a zone down low. But when the Bruins got extended possession, the Leafs sort of, I see them backing off into sort of just a very passive zone. And then that really allowed the Bruins to use all of their puck movements to break the Leafs apart and to score off the high cycle like that. So, you know, if we think back to last year when Florida upset a much stronger Boston Bruins team, they did it by playing a lot of man-on-man, whether it's, you know, taking the body on the forecheck, whether it's going man on man high in the D zone, and generally just taking the body and take away time and space and not giving the Bruins the time and space to do their, you know, really creative, really, you know, fancy fluid looking movements. So I think for the Leafs to sort of stem the tide here, I think they got to go man on man a little bit more often.
Yeah, because the Bruins are certainly trying to create those sort of defensive switches or mismatches, and especially for this Leafs team that's been incorporating players, has tried a bunch of different combinations, both with their defensemen and their forward lines. That's an interesting kind of thing to watch in terms of how they attack there. Fraser, I want to talk to you about Matthews' production and his line, because I think that's when we're talking about kind of things that have changed. The interesting wrinkle for this series is Matthews has been so good playing with Max Domi and Tyler Bertuzzi recently. And in particular with Domi, you look at their 5-on-5 minutes together. They've played just over 200. They've generated 23 goals in that time. High danger chances through the roof, expected goal share in the 65% range. All of it is phenomenal across the board. And if they're willing to kind of embrace that line construction and keep those guys together, all of a sudden that bumps down Marner to playing with Tavares's line. That bumps William Nylander then down to a third line. And all of a sudden, you've got more depth. You've got more kind of pieces to throw at a Bruins team that is certainly not nearly as deep offensively as this Leafs team. And all of, so I think that makes them kind of much more interesting and dangerous offensively, maybe compared to years past, where it was like, all right, we're just going to load a bunch of guys together. And if you stop this one group or at least give them trouble, we're not going to have very many other options. All of a sudden, the fact that you're going to have like Matthews, Marner, and Nylander all on separate lines, I'm sure they're going to switch it up eventually and put them back together. But at least for the time being, it seems like an interesting wrinkle to the series.
Absolutely. I mean, you look at last year's postseason, you know, ultimately what the results looked at 5-on-5, and what it looked like was, you know, the core star forwards creating all of the offense, and then the rest of the lineup, including, you know, guys like Ryan O'Reilly, who, you know, we know are very good hockey players, just not able to create anything. So, you know, I think the Leafs have gotten, I think, fortunate, but also, you know, obviously it's a product of good development that they've been able to kind of bring up some players, you know, some younger guys, and work them into the lineup successfully. You know, guys like Robertson and Holmberg and Knies and McMahon, for example. And, you know, be able to have kind of a more versatile forward groups that you are able to put a guy like Nylander on the third line and know that you're not giving him minutes with, you know, a David Kampf or Noah Gregor necessarily. You know, I think that could be a huge difference maker. You know, like you said, Matthews with Domi, I think, is a player who, you know, a lot of people have had issues with him in the past. You know, certainly some coaches have, because there's a lot of things that he lacks that you would maybe want from him. You know, he's obviously not as physical necessarily, at least between the whistles, as, you know, the name I think leads some people to expect. Not a very active forechecker, not super active backchecker, can be a little bit inattentive and takes quite a few penalties. But, you know, if there's one thing that he's really, really effective at, it's passing the puck and getting it to the dangerous areas. That's been the case going back to Montreal, going back to Columbus. You know, it wasn't something that he was really able to necessarily integrate in his brief time with the Hurricanes, but we saw a bit of it in the playoffs with Dallas last year. You know, obviously he's not Mitch Marner, but, you know, he gives you maybe enough of a facsimile of that playmaking ability next to Auston Matthews. And we know that Matthews is literally unmatched in the league when it comes to creating scoring chances for himself and getting to dangerous areas, let alone finishing them at a next level rate. You know, if you can basically plug in, you know, have Tyler Bertuzzi play the forechecking net front role, you know, with obviously the extra bit of skill that he provides, have Domi, you know, making the plays that he needs to make and, you know, entering the zone with possession of the puck and all the stuff that maybe Matthews doesn't love doing on his own, and then have Matthews in the middle of the ice so that you can push down Marner, insulate Tavares a little bit so he can be a pure net front guy. I suddenly like the construction of that forward group a lot more than I would if we were talking about, you know, two first lines and two fourth lines, which is how it was looking for a while.
Mm-hmm. Well, Han, even beyond just the trickle down effect that we just talked about there, I do think while, you know, Domi's making a lot of the plays upon entry, I think playing Matthews with him as opposed to Marner kind of encourages Matthews to carry the puck, at least initially in the sequence in transition, a bit more. And I think you and I have spoken in the past about how he certainly demonstrated, like, whenever you score 69 nice goals the way he did this season, you're going to do it in a variety of ways, and he can score in all different types of facets. But when he's at his best and when it's fueling the rest of his game is when he's like kind of attacking downhill, when he's driving that middle lane. And I think like encouraging him to play that way a bit more on the puck early on, all of a sudden just makes him an entirely different animal offensively in the grand scheme of things. And so I think that's part of why that's worked. But it's just interesting because it's not necessarily something we've seen them do in the postseason or have the luxury of. And all of a sudden, I think this is going to present different challenges for the Bruins in terms of what they're going to do with their matchup line, what they're going to do with their defense pairs, because they're clearly going to prioritize trying to at least make life difficult for Matthews, but how they do so then remains to be seen.
So I think it was the episode with Sean Shapiro that you did where Sean said that Jim Montgomery admitted that he was out coached, in previous playoff series. And so here's my two cents on how Jim Montgomery can not get out coached or out coached Sheldon Keefe this series, which is he's got to find a way to make Keefe lose confidence or lose trust in Max Domi. Because as Jack Fraser just noted, Max Domi is a very undisciplined player in terms of taking penalties, but I would also argue he's a very undisciplined player in terms of managing the puck. And if the Boston Bruins can show Sheldon Keefe that Max Domi is not to be trusted alongside Austin Matthews in big minutes, then all of a sudden this whole like three line deep Leafs forward lineup falls apart, because then he's got to bring up Marner, or he's going to bring up Nylander or somebody else. And now we're back to this sort of traditional top six, bottom six, where the bottom six is really not well equipped to do much of anything.
Well, I thought you were going to say, when you mentioned the lack of trust, and maybe this also ties into it as well, is how the defense pairs shake out, right? Because so much has been made of like them bringing back Lyubushkin, bringing in Edmondson. They have so many names and different combinations they could possibly use. It's interesting when you look at like the combinations they have used on the back end. All of the best ones essentially involve Timothy Liljegren. And we know that in the past, despite the fact that he's had regular season success in kind of more sheltered roles and sort of managing his minutes, in the postseason, they've been reluctant or nervous about exposing him fully, because going back and playing the puck against some of these heavy forechecks when they've had to play the Tampa Bay Lightning, for example, every year has made them nervous, and clearly they weren't comfortable doing so. And so their willingness to just like use Liljegren in a massive role here, regardless of who he's playing with, I think is also going to be a key. And that's a way this series could kind of get away from the Leafs and Keefe, if the Bruins are able to early on make him, for whatever reason, essentially relive that and then start using worse options on the blue line instead of him.
Yeah, like I don't know how these things work really, because like Sheldon's coached Timmy since he was 18 years old, back when we were all with Marlies. A lot of water has gone under the bridge, and maybe that's kind of part of it. Like, you've known this person for so long and you've seen him struggle through so many things that maybe in the back of your mind, you're like, I can't trust this guy because I know him too well. I don't know.
Fraser, I'm curious for your take on this. So this Bruins defense, because I've read a lot of previews and seen a lot of content so far, kind of, and I get why, sizing this series up as like the Leafs offense and their top forwards against the Bruins defense. And certainly, if you look at the Bruins' strength, it's suppression in terms of not giving up a lot of goals. Now, Sporlogic is giving a ton of that credit, and I think the public models as well, to the goaltending, right? Where this isn't the same Bruins defensive structure they've previously had. Their expected goals against, their inner slot shots allowed, how much time they spend in the defensive zone is all significantly higher than it's been in the past. Swayman and Allmark have both been amazing. I guess I'm curious to see how they use those two goalies then in this case, because it's certainly an advantage in the regular season, just having two starters essentially and never having a drop off regardless of who you're playing over 82 games. Are they going to still stick strictly to alternating them, or are they going to just ride one goalie, which I assume would be Swayman, because I do think he's the superior option in this series, and how that plays out? Because I think people have sort of just taken for granted that, all right, it's the Bruins, they're so good defensively, it's the same thing over and over again. But in this case, I think like they are much more reliant on their goaltending being elite than they may otherwise maybe thought of.
100%. Because I mean, like you said, you look at the goals against and you think, oh, like they've lost Bergeron without missing a beat. But you look at the underlyings and you know, there are still strengths of this team when it comes to defensive play. You know, like they are, I think, still pretty good defending entries, very good when it comes to preventing passes across the slot, which is something that the Leafs are quite fond of. So that will be kind of interesting to see whether they can mix them up like that. But yeah, I mean, this team has a lot of holes defensively. You lose a guy like Bergeron, you know, you fill the slot with guys who aren't necessarily quite as strong in their own end, and this is the result. And the question is, you know, can you count on what has been, at least in the regular season, an extremely reliable goaltending tandem? But I mean, last year, Ullmark wasn't even that bad. He was just, you know, a little below average, and you know, they lose what seemed like, you know, to most people, a surefire series. You know, this is a very tight one with some very, very talented scorers on the other side. You know, the question is, first of all, you know, are they going to play Swayman? Are they going to play Ullmark? Are they going to play them in a tandem? You know, can they even play them in a tandem at this point? Like, can you unring the bell of having almost traded Ullmark at the deadline and still have them be kind of a happy tandem who are trading starts throughout a playoff run? You know, I don't know. But I think that it's a totally valid question. And, you know, I mean, like, you look at the Bruins blue line, you know, obviously there are some players that we really love there. There's some players that we might not be so sure of. And I mean, that's the case of the Leafs as well. You know, the Leafs have, I think, decided to specifically go very big on the blue line to try to, you know, match the Bruins forwards and or the Panthers, whoever they were going to ultimately play. And, you know, you look at a guy like Andrew Peak, who's lining up with Hampus Lindholm now after being a healthy scratch with the Columbus Blue Jackets. You know, we'll see how that winds up for them. But I think it's definitely not a guarantee that we're just looking at this series and being like, okay, Toronto, that's the offense team. Boston, that's the defense team. What we might be actually seeing is neither of these teams being amazing defensively. And this could be maybe a little bit more of a run and gun type series than we might have expected.
Han, do you have any other final notes on this series, or do you want to move on to Rangers Capitals?
Just one last thing. So I talked about man on man versus zone defense off the top. I just think if the Leafs start Samsonov, they got to be aggressive. They got to just not let the Bruins shoot at all, because I don't really trust Samsonov. I think Joel Wall has been better this year. He looked better. But again, you know, the more Toronto can take away time and space in man on man coverage strategically, the better they're going to make out.
Yeah, if it's not at the start, it's certainly at some point, like, it'll be clear the Wall is the guy. Okay, let's do Rangers Capitals. I'll give you the floor here, Fraser. What from the Rangers perspective is most interesting to you? Because I think kind of unfairly, a lot has been made this season, and I get it. Like, they won the President's Trophy, so you're going to kind of nitpick, and you just look at the numbers, and it's, especially in the past, we've been trained to think of this team as sort of outperforming their expectations, being wildly efficient. It's a lot of the same in terms of, like, they're shooting off the pass and creating off of entry and all that stuff and looking for high danger chances through that cross slot passing this season. But they've also started attacking more off the rush. They have that lethal power play. And I think Sporlogic's numbers in particular paint them in a much more favorable light than maybe natural stat trick or evolving hockey. Like, they're not really, offensively, they're not actually outperforming their expected goals or higher than their goals. Defensively, they're outperforming it a little bit, but it makes sense. They have very good goaltending and strong goalie infrastructure. So with this team, where are you at with them as a contender and kind of potential exploitable weaknesses, I guess, here for a Capitals team that is going to be like clinging on to any small little hope they have in a matchup like this?
Yeah, I see them as being a very high ceiling team. You know, I think even factoring in the, you know, pre-shot movement and the other things that they bring to the table, that they are a team that at 5-on-5 hasn't given what they're totally capable of. And I think a big part of that is that they've been, when it comes to creating scoring chances, certainly not a one-line team, but I think one line has really stood apart from the rest, and that's obviously the Panarin line. So the real two questions for me, you know, are, can that line keep rolling to the extent that it has already? Because, I mean, we've seen Panarin hit another level. We've seen Lafreniere certainly hitting another level, really slotting in perfectly next to him. And we've seen, you know, an amazing season, I think, from Vincent Trocheck as well. Them clicking as well as they have, the question for me throughout the season when people would ask me, what do I think of the Rangers as a contender, has been whether that line can keep doing what it's been doing through the playoffs, or, you know, our team's going to collapse. Are they going to take away that passing lane in the middle of the ice? You know, are they going to stop Lafreniere from being able to get open for those tap-ins that, you know, he's made a name for himself scoring, you know, in part because, like Gensel, he's so smart when it comes to manipulating time and space. You know, and I think he's kind of been able to play that role really well next to Panarin. The second one would be whether we're going to see Zibanejad and Kreider as a pair start to really make things happen at 5-on-5. We know what they can do on the man advantage. We certainly know what they're capable of doing at 5-on-5 when it comes down to it. But I just don't think we've seen the best from them so far this season. And whether, you know, maybe we see depth pieces like Kako kind of come into the mix and fill in the blanks a little bit. You know, I think it's valid, but you know, I really think a lot of what this team has been able to do offensively has been based on the power play, and it is a great power play. But one thing I would really like to see them do, and what I think theoretically, you know, and of course anything can happen, theoretically should be a fairly straightforward series for them against the Capitals, would be just to develop that 5-on-5 game and really kind of take control of this series at even strength, with the power play just kind of being the icing on top instead of the thing that drives their offense.
Yeah, certainly for Panarin, like I think a lot's been made of previous sort of playoff disappointments and him not shooting the puck enough, not being aggressive enough, looking for his opportunities. And he made a point this season playing with Lafreniere as a bit more of a distributor and puck carrier like he was in Major Junior, to all of a sudden embrace that and set career highs in shot attempts, shots on goal, goals. And so if he can carry that over, I think that's going to be a huge kind of stepping stone and first step for an awesome playoff run. It totally changes that narrative and perception of him. Han, whether it's from the Rangers or from the Capitals and kind of what they can do, I know you in your preview on your Substack, you had a very interesting note about the Capitals' extreme zone deployment for their forwards and kind of how they use their fourth line to make life easier for some of their younger forwards. Give us something on the Capitals and kind of what you're looking for from them in this series.
So first of all, as big as a mismatch as a series is from a standings perspective, it's also behind the bench, because obviously Peter Laviolette won the cup previously. He's gone on several deep playoff runs with a variety of teams playing a variety of different styles, whereas Spencer Carberry is obviously a rookie NHL head coach. So it'll be interesting to see as the series evolves what the chess match looks like, what the adjustments look like. One of the things that, as you mentioned, I wrote about this morning is, I would say Washington's most remarkable line is their checking line of Nick Dowd down the middle with Malinston and Obey Clavel. And the thing that I think is really interesting and the kind of thing that like coaches would really zone in on is that Nick Dowd is a right-handed player. And for the Rangers, their two best centers, Zibanejad and Trocheck, are also right-handed players, which means that whenever they have an ozone face-off, especially on the power play where the Rangers would get to pick the side, they're always going to pick Dowd's backhand side. So a righty taking the face-off at the left dot defensively, which is the right dot offensively. And I went and looked at the face-off splits for Dowd on Instat this morning, and there was a big mismatch against the Rangers top two centers in terms of winning faceoffs. And again, at 5-on-5, it doesn't really matter all that much, but when we're talking about the first faceoff of a power play where you can run a lot of set plays, where obviously you have 2 minutes left on the clock with that man advantage, that can make a big difference.
I'm looking forward to that. That's very interesting. Fraser, a lot's been made certainly, and I think people get it by now, the goal differential, the record in one goal games, all that stuff for the Capitals, how improbable it is that they made the playoffs with a statistical profile. And I think they would even admit as much, because you look at what they did at the deadline and they traded three roster players for essentially exclusively draft picks and still made the playoffs anyways, in large part because of the teams around them in the wildcard race. Now, I think it's worth noting a lot of the games earlier in the season were like Darcy Kuemper games, and he clearly struggled. When they used Charlie Lindgren, he was significantly better and gave them a real chance to win. Even in the games they played this year head-to-head against New York, he gave the Rangers quite a bit of trouble, giving up only 4 goals against in 3 games on 90 shots. What's interesting about this Capitals team is, yeah, I'm just trying to construct an argument for like how they could make this a fascinating series and really give the Rangers problems. And part of it stems for me the fact that they play such a low event game. And I think that's obviously by design, acknowledging they're on a talent deficit, where that inherently opens the door for more variance, right? You're getting into these games where they've played this season and it's like shots are 21 to 24, shots are 25 to 22. And just fewer events that way increases the likelihood that anything can happen in terms of randomness. They just score a few times and all of a sudden they hang on, Charlie Lindgren's playing well, they win. Whereas if there's more events, higher likelihood the talent wins out, and they don't want that. So I think that's what I'm going to be watching for, to see if they can kind of get the Rangers to play that type of game. And if the Rangers, who aren't necessarily a big shot volume team themselves, sort of indulge them in that, and kind of what the trickle-down effect of that is.
Yeah, I think in addition to that, you know, because of the moves that they made, I think the Caps did keep a couple roster slots open for younger players. So, you know, the Rangers rush defense isn't terrific if we're expecting that the Rangers are going to be spending a lot of time in the Capitals. And, you know, we could see the counterattack start to go. I mean, the Capitals have not been a strong rush team at all this season. But I feel like there is a possibility that it could happen. And like you said, if things are being kept relatively low event, if Lindgren is playing well, then that could potentially be a source of frustration for the Rangers, and they could fall victim to, you know, that syndrome that we've seen from President's Trophy teams in the past, where you start to kind of panic and collapse, and you know, that's I think it's unlikely, but you know, I think there is an outside possibility that that could happen. We do also have to entertain the possibility that the Tom Wilson show starts to take shape. I mean, the Rangers have had their issues with Wilson in the past. It could develop into a bit of a sideshow. Never out of the question that Wilson could, you know, make a questionable hit on a key contributor for the Rangers, kind of knock them off path. Conversely, he might be running around trying to make that happen, and that Rangers power play could be feasting on the Capitals as a result. But I see that as maybe a potential, you know, that might be very more into the narrative side than the X of the nose side, but something that it would be interesting to see develop through what, you know, otherwise would seem to be shaping up as a fairly sleepy, skippable series.
No, I'm with you. I think this Rangers team this season certainly has, when they've looked bad, it's because teams have been taking advantage of them off the rush. This Capitals team is 30th in rush chances this season, so they might not be the team to do so, but something to keep in mind as we move forward in the playoffs. We've still got a couple more minutes here. Let's do some notes on the Oilers and Kings. We don't know who they're playing yet, but we didn't do them in part one when we talked about the West teams. So let's do a few notes on that. Han, I'll let you go on the Oilers here. What are you watching for from them? What interests you ahead of their round one series against whoever it is?
So I'm interested in how the Oilers are going to deploy their defensemen. Over the season, there seems to be a shift away from Darnell Nurse as their number one defenseman in terms of competition and usage. I firmly believe that Evan Bouchard is their best defenseman and should be getting a lot of minutes. His pairing with Mattias Ekholm has been excellent ever since they got put together. So, you know, I know a lot of the fan base, they give some grief to Bouchard for, you know, missing coverage and making mistakes and turnovers at some point. But, you know, he's by far their number one defenseman at this point, I would say. And if they roll with him and they continue to give him a big role, I think we're going to see some good things.
Oh, undoubtedly. They play those two guys with McDavid and they absolutely mash. I think I'll take you a step further. Fraser, it's interesting in looking at their two most recent kind of big games at home against the Golden Knights and Avs in particular. Not only did they not use Nurse and CeCe as their matchup pair, they actually used Kulak and Desharnais more against both Eichel and McKinnon than they did CeCe and Nurse. And so they really softened the matchup minutes for that CeCe Nurse pair. Now, Kulak and Desharnais have been really good this year together. I still have in the back of my mind this memory of what Desharnais looked like in the postseason last year against Speed and him making mistakes and kind of being exposed. So, you know, it was kind of his first showing in terms of NHL playoffs. It's highly possible that those two guys are able to better handle that role. But I think that is something to watch moving forward because they're certainly going to be tested if they're not going to rely on CeCe and Nurse. And I don't blame them considering their results, not just this year, but in the past as well.
Yeah, 100%. And I'm, you know, if they weren't going to get Darnell Nurse, Alex Carrier, like we were insisting that they do a couple of months ago on the Deadline podcast, I'm at least pleased to see that they're being maybe a little bit more circumspect of what that pairing is capable of. And I think it will benefit them because, you know, Darnell Nurse is a good hockey player. Like, he's not a total liability. He just didn't really fit the mold of what they were forcing him into. And now that they have Mattias Ekholm on that left side, who is that more kind of traditional, you know, shut down two-way defenseman, I'm glad that they're able to be more realistic. But, you know, one factor that I'm curious to see happen, you know, they add Adam Henrique at the deadline. That gave them, I think, a lot of flexibility. You know, they now have kind of four guys who you could visualize as being kind of top six center options, depending on how they want to deploy their units with McDavid, Draisaitl, Nugent Hopkins, and Henrique. Obviously, they have preferences for who they actually deploy in the middle. But, you know, I'm curious if the time will inevitably come, you know, if they're down in this series, in whatever series they end up playing, if we see the McDavid Draisaitl reunion. Where are we going to see Vander Kane? Who's going to get the minutes with Nugent Hopkins? Is Henrique going to end up being the third line center? You know, there's a whole lot of kind of play that they have to do with that forward group before it ends up becoming the final one. And I'm kind of curious to see where things will shake out because, you know, I mean, this team, there's a reason that they were considered the favorite heading into the season. You know, I was crunching the numbers in terms of, you know, just their pure kind of expected goals. You know, you keep goaltending and finishing completely neutral. And, you know, I think keeping everything like that constant, their expected goals standing space was like 120 points. And we know that this team has some very talented finishers on it, obviously, between McDavid and Draisaitl alone. You know, the goaltending, always a bit of an issue with this Oilers team. You never really can know what you're going to count on. But, you know, even if they don't get staggering goaltending, I think this will be a really difficult out.
Yeah, offensively, they're just an absolute machine. They're first in expected goals, first in high danger chances, first in inner slot shots, first in whole zone time. It's just all off the charts. I think we certainly are going to see situationally, depending on score or the team just struggling, like they've got that McDavid, Leon Draisaitl nuclear option, break in case of emergency. We will see that. But you're right. There's so many moving parts here because I think McDavid and Hyman together, regardless of who's playing with them, will be successful. We've seen Henrik there a bit recently. We've seen Henrik also play on the wing with Draisaitl. I personally prefer when they just load up Draisaitl with the speed of Fogel and McLeod and just let those guys run wild. And I think that's a really interesting look. But I think we've also seen that kind of Henrik and RNH at this point are probably better suited as wingers rather than anchoring their own line as centers. And so that kind of doesn't make that as feasible. So we'll see what they do, but there's certainly a bunch of moving parts there. And I have confidence they'll get it right. Even if it's not right off the top, they eventually will, because this coaching staff so far has actually very pleasantly, in my opinion, put players in a position to succeed with their deployment and made the right changes when they needed to. So I'll be watching for that. Han, any notes on the Kings here on the way out as the final team we got to cover before round one?
I mean, they haven't really added this season. I just think Quinton Byfield absolutely needs to take a step and be their best player for them to have a chance to go deep. You know, it's not going to be Kopitar who does everything in all situations. You know, because let's say they play against Edmonton again. Well, you know, Edmonton's gotten better. The Kings, in terms of their personnel, like their young players, they haven't really taken that step. Jordan Spence is a nice depth defenseman, but really, you know, if Byfield can single-handedly kind of shut down Bouchard and take him off his game and forecheck and score and drive play and protect the puck, then the Kings might have a chance there.
Yeah, Fraser, I don't really know what to do with this team because they've been winning some games here recently, but also you look at their schedule and it's been incredibly soft. They've been sort of beating up on inferior teams. Defensively, the numbers are all very strong. They're second in expected goals, second in slot shots allowed. They're second on the penalty kill. All that's good, and they do a good job of insulating Rittich and Talbot and net. But offensively, I think what Han was kind of alluding to there, like I was hoping that with the additions they made, with the big steps they made in the offseason in terms of personnel, they would take a step. They would revamp their offense. And you look, even since the coaching change, they're 22nd in 5-on-5 goals. They're 23rd in 5-on-5 shooting percentage. They're once again struggling to get the puck into those high danger areas and then convert, particularly at 5-on-5. Their power play has been better. But that's kind of the limiting factor here once again. And it feels like we could basically essentially just, I know there's some different names involved because of the trades they made, but we could essentially just clip our Kings conversation from our round one previews last year and the year before and apply it to this, and it wouldn't really change that much.
Yeah. Good off the rush, not super creative passers, not incredible finishers, copy paste, we're done. Yeah, I totally agree with Jack. Like, part of the price of kind of trying to skip ahead the rebuild is that you don't get the opportunity to draft as much high octane offensive talent, which means that, you know, the one guy that you did get is going to have to be a superstar, because right now the problem with the Kings relative to the rest of the field here is that they don't have that separation skilled player who's just going to be able to take a game over offensively. You know, there's one guy on the table who has the possibility of doing that. It's Byfield. You know, I mean, can I envision a situation where the Kings just grind their way out to an excruciating Cinderella run here purely off the strength of their defense and just win low event hockey games? Yes. Do I want to? No. So I would much rather see, if it's going to happen, I would like to see it being led by, you know, a huge breakout from Quinton Byfield.
Yes, I co-sign that completely. All right, we did it. We talked about all 16 playoff teams ahead of round one. Han, I'll give you the floor here. what do you want to plug and tell the listeners about your hockey tactics in particular, because I found it super helpful for visualizing some of the stuff in preparation for a show like this. And I think if the listeners enjoy this conversation, they will, I think, likewise enjoy it as well.
So if you're new to my work, you can go check out some free content at jhanhky.substack.com. So there's a free and a paid option, but even if you get the free option, I'll send you some tactics, you know, X's and O's, like deep dives a couple of times a week, from, you know, someone who coaches pro hockey right now. And, you know, not a lot of them are going to share their secrets with you, but I will. So check that out.
Fraser, what do you want to plug?
Well, I got to write 8 playoff previews before these series start. So I sure hope that somebody will read them. So if you're interested in what we've talked about and you'd like statistical breakdowns, I will be going through each series, kind of offense versus defense, stylistic matchups, using a variety of stats, including kind of macro level stuff, as well as the more stylistic stuff from all three zones. And while I'm at it, I'm going to plug all three zones as well. Coordinator's tracking project. He always tracks the playoffs as well, posts really insightful stuff throughout. And it's been a hugely helpful resource as I've made these previews. So I would recommend you check that out as well.
Oh, awesome. Good shout there. Fellas, we did it. My only plug is for people to jump into Discord if they aren't there already. Both of these lads who are on today are in there. I think it's going to be a great place and a great resource during the playoffs to come watch games live, chat, hang out with like-minded individuals, particularly in round one when there's just so much going on every single night. And that's all for today. So there's lots there to digest. We did our best to get these previews out as quickly as possible so you'd have some time to actually enjoy them. Enjoy the start of the 2024 postseason. And I'll see you back here on Monday when we get actual playoff games to discuss. So looking forward to that. In the meantime, thank you to everyone for listening to the Hockey PDOcast on the Sportsnet Radio Network.